Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening and welcome to the Tattered Cover Bookstore. I want to start off by thanking you for supporting your local independent bookseller. It's your patronage that makes events like this possible here at the Tattered Cover. It's my pleasure tonight to introduce Anthony Swoford as he reads from and signs his latest book, a memoir in which he candidly articulates the struggle to come to terms with a difficult father, his experiences of war, and an excessive post-fame lifestyle that nearly killed him. Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails is a riveting and ultimately redemptive journey that fellow author Tim O'Brien describes as candid as a locomotive. Written with a fury and grace, this book has a dangerous, achingly desperate personality of its own. Please join me in welcoming Anthony Swoford to the Tattered Cover.
Hi there. Thanks a lot for coming out on this. Is it usually 99 and 100 degrees in June? No, okay. I hope you didn't travel as far or for as long as I did. I left my door in Woodstock, New York at about 5:30 a.m. Mountain Time and landed here about 6:30 Mountain Time. I blame United Airlines. None of you, but I'm happy to be here at the Tattered Cover to return here at one of my favorite bookstores. I know it's out here in the world, and it makes me happy to know it's one of the great surviving independent bookstores and helps keep American literary culture alive, which is very important. And they have the coolest green urinals in the men's room, too. So if you're able to check them out, please do. Worth a trip. I'm going to read a bit from my book and then open it up for questions. I'm going to pop around a little bit, and I'll open it up to questions, comments, insults. I charge a little more for insults, about $10 an insult, $5 for questions. There are days I still fantasize about combat, long nights when I wish I had rejoined the Marines as an infantry officer after September 11th and gone back over and got some war to score that kill I'd missed the first time. Most people don't understand that desire, but I was born a war baby. My father impregnated my mother while in Honolulu on R&R from Vietnam, and I believed that there existed no grander test for a man than combat. Every other pursuit was pure, unimportant leisure when compared to a firefight. I didn't know if another war would make me a better man, but it might. It certainly would have changed me, or it might have killed me. What did I do instead of heading back to war? My first book, Jarhead, was turned into a movie, and I wrote and published a novel. I divorced one woman, and I spent many years falling in love with various versions of the wrong woman and walking away from the right woman once. I bought two engagement rings. I bought a beautiful apartment on West 19th Street in Manhattan. I taught at a few different colleges. I ate at some of the best restaurants in the world, Paris, Madrid, Tokyo, Istanbul, and at some of the worst, in Ho Chi Minh City and Australia's Pilbara. I spent an unconscionable amount of money on Burgundy wine, and I drank most of it. I bought and used the occasional batch of recreational drugs. I nearly killed myself in a $60,000 sports car. I watched my father get sicker and sicker from a heinous disease that was probably partially the result of his 23 years in the military and his exposure to Agent Orange. I thought about killing myself for months on end. A few times I fantasized about killing my father. I flew women to London and Tokyo and Oakland and Seattle and other cities I've forgotten. Once, I slept in a hotel room in Shinjuku, Tokyo, with my girlfriend, Ava. Staying in a room 10 floors below us was a woman named Anya, whom I'd flown to Tokyo from Munich. And a few metro stops away in Roppongi was a Japanese girl I just spent a week with, before my girlfriend, Ava, and my ex-girlfriend, Anya, arrived. Somehow, I had sex with all of these women throughout the week, and I did not get caught. That is to say, I took risks, and the meaning of the word girlfriend had a lot of elasticity. I thought I'd created a new language of lust, but really I spoke artifice and despair. I told so many lies about my whereabouts late at night or early in the morning, I'm certain I set a record for the audacity of my libido. I believe that having been a Marine and having gone to war helped me become a great liar. Growing up with a Vietnam War veteran for a father helped me become a liar too. I learned this from my father. If the lie will not get you blown up, the lie is worth whatever the cost. My father excelled at deceit. He deceived his wife and children about what kind of husband and father he was, but mostly he deceived himself about how that little war in Southeast Asia had changed him. Like many combat veterans I know, my father and I live with the wickedly exciting and doggedly exhausting knowledge that we had once, for a short period of time, flirted with death and won. This knowledge is like a drug, the purest cocaine or 80-year-old Highland single malt scotch. Once you have had some, it alters your understanding of the world and of other people and of consequences. If I lied to a lover about what neighborhood or city or country I'd slept in the night before, it really didn't matter. The relationship might sour, but she would never kill me. Lying about sex became fun. It became a hobby. Manhattan bored me, drinking bored me, drugs bored me, but lying about sex never bored me. Eventually, I had wasted such a massive amount of money on women, wine, drugs, cars, and booze that my dissipation and deceit blew up in my face. I looked up one day and could no longer afford the mortgage on my apartment. I had to sell and became, in a way, homeless. I would have liked to ask my father for advice, but at the time our relationship was in complete disrepair. But for some time my father had owned a Winnebago and a dream, that we two traverse the country and come to an understanding and discover a friendship. One trip wasn't enough, neither was two, it took three. I might read from a little bit of one of those RV trips, but first I'm going to read from one of the hospital scenes. The hotels, hospitals, and jails of the title are all metaphors, no actual places. No, that's not true. The hospitals, one of the hospitals is a Bethesda Naval Hospital, which I visited to spend some time around some injured Marines who'd just been, most of them blown up and shot within a few days of me meeting them on the ward there. Somewhere between Elizabeth and Princeton, I looked at my speedometer and realized that I was going 120 miles per hour. In my mind, I'd been back in the desert driving a Humvee, spraying my M16 all over the place. My right hand gripped the gear shift as though it were the pistol grip on my rifle. No, as though it were the pistol grip on my life. But I had no ammunition here on the road to Bethesda, and the targets remained unclear. I poured water over my head and blasted the radio. I took the speedometer down to 90 and kept it there. I thought of the young kids missing limbs at Bethesda. What on earth would I say to them? I found the hospital, and I found a group of Marines who were going to help me get up to the ward. A staff sergeant greeted me. "Can I help you, boss?" He wore a shrapnel-enhanced smirk, and in his eyes swam the deep, constant pain of having killed and watched others die. "I'm here to meet up with the disabled American veterans," I said. "Swofford?" he asked. "Yes." It had been years since I'd spoken to a Marine staff sergeant in uniform. I hadn't done anything wrong, but still he made me nervous. This guy had been jacked up overseas. He was probably 10 years younger than I, but he looked hard and he looked mean, and I knew he had lived some years. When I was a corporal in the Corps, I looked up to staff sergeants as if they were gods. "Fucking jarhead," he said. He half smiled, but I wasn't sure if he wanted to shake my hand or punch me in the face. I was wearing a suit. I must have looked like a real civilian piece of shit to him. "Hey, PFC Cologne, weren't you with 2-7? The sergeant yelled over his shoulder. "Hell yes, I was." "Jarhead is here," the staff sergeant said. In the Corps, I'd gotten used to being called fuckface and retard and shit for brains, but for many years now, people had called me Tony or Anthony or Swofford or Swoff. I had not yet acclimated to being called by the title of my first book. "You can call me Swofford," I said, and we finally shook hands. Cologne came from behind the cubicle. He had the youthful gleam and game on his face of a Dominican from New York, a kid who had probably seen as much crazy shit in the neighborhood as he ever had in the Corps, other than that IED that blew him up. He was in a wheelchair. "Swofford," Cologne said. "Yeah, we all read that book. Man, and the movie, that has some lucky shit for you. Me, not so lucky. Sniper, spinal cord, paraplegic. I can't even jack off." "When did you get hit?" I asked. "August 05. I think it was a Chechen. He shot me like no Quran-drunk Haji ever could. That rash of sniper casualties, right? And then they stopped, I said. Yeah, we either killed him or he went back to Chechnya when his visa expired. Cologne laughed. That was the thing that always blew my mind about injured Marines. Here was Cologne, a fiercely handsome young man of 19 or 20 who would never get laid again. And his attitude was so overwhelmingly positive and so filled with humor and delight at the madness of it all. I'd seen the same attitude while hanging around Camp Pendleton a few years earlier, and it was hard for me not to break down in front of this overwhelmingly positive outlook. Didn't he want to know why? Didn't he want to rage against the world? Someday he would, when the Corps' goodwill ran out and it canceled his sweet desk job, or when he showed up at the VA one bright day in a decade with a broken wheelchair and they handed him a wrench to fix it himself. It would happen, I knew, but for now let Cologne have his humor and his youth, I thought. So you want to go see some injured Marines, the staff sergeant asked. Excuse me. Cologne said, there are some fucked up Marines up there, Swofford. This ain't no 100-day war. This ain't no friendly fire, boo-hoo, I didn't get to shoot at the bad guys, BS. He popped wheelies in his chair, and he looked right through me. I knew he was challenging me in my easy little war, and I let him have it because he was right. My war was not shit, and his was. I wrote a book out of my little war, and from his war, he got blown up. You do the math. This is the real deal, man. I mean, double amps, faces blown off, brains splattered to the funky cold Medina and back. You think I got it bad? I ain't got shit bad on some of those fucked up motherfuckers. You want to see some fucked up jarheads? Go on and see the show. I'd forgotten how much Marines curse. Motherfucker was the equivalent of, oh really, or no kidding. Or you could use the word to talk about the cosmos and life and death. Two guys could sit on watch for 4 hours in the middle of the night, and the only word that would pass between them would be motherfucker. But that word meant, here come some suspicious bastards. I don't think she's cheating on me. I go home in 3 days. Do you think the Rig Veda is correct when it says, breath of the gods, embryo of the universe, this god wanders wherever he pleases? What is the mood up there, I asked. Cologne was popping wheelies and doing 360s in his wheelchair, and he said, most of the guys got a pretty good attitude, but, you know, if a guy didn't lose his stuff, you know, that's good. When a guy loses his junk, wakes up, you know this, the first thing he does is reach down to see if he's still got it on him. And then he looks at the doctor or the nurse and says, is it going to work? Or if he no longer has hands, he just looks, cranes his neck to see the bulge. I did know this, that at one level, the carnage breaks down to the dudes who lost their dicks and the dudes who didn't. I'd need a year on the ward to figure out all the other layers of love and hatred and confusion and ecstasy. How long will most of these guys be here, I asked. You know, that's up to the docs. A month for some, 6 for others. And then some guys, they'll send over to that hellhole Walter Reed and fit with a bionic arm or leg. A guy might not even want to have sex after jacking off with a bionic hand for a few months. Bionic hand won't tell you to take out the garbage or that it's got a headache. Cologne said this loudly, and it elicited howls from all corners of the office. I thought that was pretty funny, guys. Come on, you can laugh. Loosen up. Am I stressing you out? All right. I'm sure they'd heard it before, and I had no doubt it would remain funny for many years. And you see, with me, Swofford, I got some new territory to explore with the ladies, Cologne said, because, like, I never went down before. We just don't do that shit where I'm from. But if I want a woman now, I got to rethink my strategy. You know, you ever see that movie Coming Home? So the crippled Vietnam vet, John Voight, he goes down on Hanoi Jane like crazy. I think it's the best movie orgasm of the 1970s. Honestly, I don't think Hanoi Jane could have faked that one. The sergeant said, Cologne Googled cunnilingus in films and got back about 5,000 hits. He's running all those movies and learning technique. Cologne continued to pop wheelies. What I'm going to do is write this manual, right? It's going to be called The Finer Points of Going Down. Maybe the Naval Academy will publish it and turn it into a textbook. More laughs from behind the cubicles. I'd heard differing opinions about the quality of the health care the injured were receiving. Without any medical training and without talking to the troops, there wasn't a lot I'd learn, but I thought I could hang back and observe. To observe and deduct had been most of my job in the Marine Corps, and it was now, too. So I do it here and see what I could come up with. A naval officer from the Bethesda media team arrived to escort me to the injured Marine floor. I made plans with the Marines to meet up with them later at a dinner in D.C. As we walked onto the ward, my first impulse was to bolt. I hadn't been to a hospital since my brother died. I knew the smells and the sounds, the antiseptics and the low whirl of machines that give and take life. I knew the collective heartbeat of a hospital floor holding so many lives in fine balance. I did not belong here. I would wreck the balance. But that was not the plan of the day. For me to leave was not the plan of the day. The naval officer showed me into a room where a mother bent over her young Marine son. He'd arrived 2 days before. They were not sure the kid would live. A week earlier, he'd taken a sniper round to the forehead. The swelling was down. He blinked when his mother spoke to him. But he could blink for only a few hours a day. I remembered that the family was from Ohio. Someone from the naval media team asked me to sign a copy of Jarhead for the kid. I wrote it out to Tommy or Timmy or whatever his name was, knowing he'd never read it. His mother took the book from me, politely, and she smiled and said she'd read it to him. And I thought, Jesus, please read the kid something with a little bit of hope, not my bleak book. What are you going to give a mother from Ohio to read over the deathbed of her 19-year-old son, I thought. I walked out of the room with my minders. My brain hurt. I was short of breath and thirsty. The minders got called away for a moment, and they asked me to stand by. Ahead of me in the hall, I saw a man in his 50s leaning against the wall outside a patient room. He wore a red T-shirt emblazoned with Marine Dad. The guy was big. He'd once been an ox of a football player, somewhere in the Middle West, I guessed. I approached him. "Excuse me, sir," I asked. "Can I ask you a few questions?" "Who are you, son?" I read former Marine officer right away, Vietnam, 68 to 70. I thought I could see it in his eyes. "I'm a former Marine and a writer. I wrote a book about the Gulf War, and I'm here to listen to some stories. Who are you visiting?" "My boy," he said, and he pointed at his sweatshirt and looked at me as though I were stupid. He continued, "He's in surgery right now, below the knee on one leg, above the knee on the other, once it all shakes out. God damn it, son, I was in Nam and I saw a lot of men die, but I've just spent 3 weeks up here and I never saw men injured so heinously. The boys are ripped to shreds. Go room to room and you'll see. And look at all the mothers. I'm one of the only fathers up here, because the fathers are back at home earning money or they've never been around. I retired a year ago. I've got two pensions. I can do this for the rest of my life, but look at these mothers. Some of them are married, but you know the story. Many of these boys come from broken homes, poor homes, single mothers. These women, they thought they were going to refashion themselves after 50, live new and dazzling adventures, but they're going to be feeding and bathing their sons for the rest of their lives. He placed his hand on my shoulder and asked me to look after any Marine I ever could, and I said that I would. A woman approached. She was clutching copies of a newspaper article to her chest. "This is the article they ran on Sam yesterday in the paper. It's so touching," she said. "They captured him. He couldn't speak, but he blinked his eyes and they captured his soul." The woman began to cry and the Marine dad comforted her. "May I give you one of these about my son?" she asked me. "Yes, ma'am," I said. I glanced at the article, a front page story with color photo from Wednesday's paper in Anywhere USA. This woman at her son's bedside, the son immobile, neck brace, oxygen mask, legs in traction, the boy barely visible beneath his bouquet of medical material. "Who are you with?" she asked. Just then my minders arrived and introduced me to the woman. She asked for a signed book and I gave her one. She told me that a week or so before, Wolfowitz had been on the ward, but she was much more excited to meet me. I thought that was quite an endorsement. The woman told me that the care her son received was top-notch and that the support staff had been wonderful. I glanced at the photo of her son on the cover of the newspaper. "He's a sweet boy," she said. The Marine dad walked away. The woman looked at me and said, "I'm happy for him. His son has a small wound. When losing most of both of your legs was a small wound, I would never be able to truly understand the depth of the despair these Marines and their families were suffering. During my war, I'd spent a short time at the entry point of this calamity, at the end where the bombs blew and rifles and RPGs shattered bodies, where warthogs sometimes fired on friendly troops, and I had totally forgotten about this end, the sick end, the destroyed end, the utter ruin of families. "May I hug you?" the woman asked. "Yes, of course." I felt awkward, but I couldn't say no, could I? And she hugged me tight. She gripped me for life, for a memory of who her son had been. Young, clean-shaven, strong. I was none of these things, of course, but she would never again hug her son while he stood upright. She wept into my shoulder. The lioness had lost her family. The moon darkened, ice caps melted. How could we go on? She locked onto my eyes in a mildly wild and erotic way, her face full of tears. She was attractive in that high school librarian way, orderly and considered. Handsome, that's what she was, and sturdy. And she possessed the orderly smell of all good mothers. Her son would be fine. He would never walk, and he might not talk, but he would have his mother, and somehow they would both know this and be well. This could not have been true, but it is what I told myself then, and it is the same lie that other Americans have been telling themselves for a decade, and we believe this because we have to. Nurses and orderlies swam around us in a school of green and blue scrubs. From every room came the nauseating white sounds of resuscitation, prolongation, the beginnings of altered lives. One of the minders grabbed me at the elbow and ushered me on to another room. Sorry. In the two visitors' chairs of the room sat an extremely old woman and a girl who could not have been older than 10. They wore colorful indigenous clothing that to my untrained eye shouted Bolivia. The old woman chewed at her leathery lower lip, and the young girl beamed a smile that was as incongruous as their dress. My minders introduced me to the Marine. He was an infantry staff sergeant and had been blown up in a convoy. Both of his legs were in traction. He said, "I'm going to walk, man. I'm going to walk again." His face bore the burns from human shrapnel. He said, "My guys got blown up, you know. I lived. I got blown up. And I woke up right here in this bed. How many days later? I don't even know. I was having this dream of the Philippines, like a little island, and there were women, and I was with my platoon, and we were partying with the women. But I open my eyes and look at the end of the bed, and there are sitting my grandmother and my niece. And I haven't seen anyone from Bolivia in 14 years since I left. And I think, well, goddamn, I died in Baghdad. And here I am in heaven with my grandma and my niece. Isn't that nice? But then I think, wait, they aren't dead. How can they be dead? And then they walk up to my side and say, 'You are alive.'" The grandma eyed me suspiciously, and the little girl continued her intense and beautiful smile. "I love the Corps, man," he said. "Can you believe I got blown up in Baghdad? And before I even wake up here in the U.S., they bring in my grandma and my niece?" I had to admit that I was totally impressed. All I want to do is go back and fight again. Fight for my dead brothers. I could see he was lightly doped up, and it looked as if he got shot up again through his IV, because he faded away into a deep mind wander. Where did the drugs take his brain, I wondered. Back to the desert or that Philippine island stalked by willing women, the West's Shangri-La, not unlike the Muslims' promised land, overflowing with virgins for every martyr. My minder showed me out of the hospital. How are we doing on time? So I don't have a watch at all. It's 8 o'clock. Okay. So I can read a little bit more. And then okay. Is that okay with everyone? Okay. Let's see. Sorry, I've been at this for about 2 weeks now. I should know all my page numbers, right? Sorry. There's a Colorado RV stop, but it might be just full of too much profanity for me to read here tonight. But I highly recommend it. I emptied the septic system on my dad's Winnebago in Grand Junction. And, you ever see Winnebago Man, the guy, Jack Rebney? So there are these great outtakes on YouTube, and he was a guy who did the like the commercials for, like, if you bought a Winnebago, then you'd get this. I suppose it was a VHS tape back in the day with this guy, Jack Rebney, explaining your Winnebago to you. Really, he was a super foul-mouthed guy. And the outtakes are hilarious. He's like, "So here in your Winnebago, God, you're fucking Winnebago. You're an idiot for buying a Winnebago." And like, "Okay, let's do this again." Anyway, you'll go home tonight. You'll YouTube it. You'll be glad. If for no other reason, you'll be glad you came here tonight, because you'll now know Jack Rebney. And you'll check out the Jack Rebney section of my book. Yeah, that's not it. This is an RV trip with my dad, and we were heading west from Atlanta. I was supposed to make it all the way to California with him. And at the time, I was living in the Catskill Mountains in this thing that I called a cabin. But later I met this woman who became my wife, and she said, "You were living in a shed, man." And I drove by recently, and I was like, yeah, she might have been right. That may actually be a shed. But I'm gonna just keep calling it a cabin. But so I hooked up with my dad on this RV trip, and we were heading west. Near Houston, we saw a fuel tanker catch fire on the roadside. The flame shot 100 feet in the air. We pulled into a roadside hotel, and my father slept in his rig, and I got a room for the night. I could never sleep with him in that thing. In the morning, while my father took his medications, he's got COPD, emphysema, basically. I went for a long run. It was 100 degrees, and I was out of shape, and about 3 miles out, down a long, flat road, I was pretty certain that I'd initiated a cataclysmic cardiac event. I thought, Jesus Christ, my sick old man is in his RV sucking in meds for his failing lungs, and I'm going to have a fucking heart attack on the side of the road and die a week before I turn 40, in the middle of nowhere in Texas, with an unfinished novel languishing on my laptop. There along the deserted road in Texas, I swore off drugs of all kinds. An old lady in a powder blue Cadillac stopped and asked me if I needed a ride, and I said, oh, yes, I do. I swear she looked something like Jesus. The air conditioning in her car was the best I'd experienced in my life. Back in the RV over a lunch of canned soup, my father said, can you help me out with something I've been trying to figure out, Tone? I'll give it a shot, I said. I don't understand why you rented out that fancy New York City apartment and moved up to the woods to live in a cabin or a shack, whatever you're calling it. I'd been lying to my father. I'd told him that I was renting my Chelsea apartment to a friend and that I decided to move to the woods to escape the city for a while. I mean, he said, I seen photos of that Manhattan apartment and I seen photos of that shack, and I don't see why any young single man would choose to move to the woods when he got that bachelor pad in the city. Ain't all the women in the city? I can confirm, Dad, that most of the women are in the city, but I'm not young. I'll be 40 next week. Is it like a private writer's retreat or something like that? I just don't get it, Tone. Don't make a lick of sense to me. I could not keep the lie going any longer. I said, there's an earlier chapter in the book where I reproduce a letter that my father had sent me in 2006, sort of outlining the various ways in which I was an awful son. And I offer many, many pages of rebuttal, but for your reading pleasure. I said, in that letter you sent me a few years back, you said that someday you would see me on my way down. Well, here I am, Pops. I'm on my way down. You got what you wanted. I'm in total and complete financial ruin. I had to sell my apartment to scratch up some cash to live on. I live in a shack in the Catskills because it's all I can afford right now. I never wanted you to fail, he said. I just wanted to point out to you that sometimes people make money and it changes them. And then they turn around and they have nothing. Not money, not family. Money don't mean shit. You always got family if you don't alienate them. I left the RV and went to the hotel pool. By now it must have been over 110 degrees out. There were no vehicles other than my father's RV in the parking lot, and I assumed no employees would leave the air-conditioned comfort of the hotel. I took off my clothes and stepped into the pool. I floated belly up for as long as I could take the sun burning my body. I thought, so that's it. I've assumed for all these years that my father wanted me to fail, but in fact he did not want me to fail. And so now I've failed in order to give him what he wanted, but it's not what he wanted. From the pool, I watched my father moving around in his RV. He lived alone in Fairfield, California, and he mostly traveled alone in the RV. I knew that this solitary life he had created for himself fit in well with his fantasies of being a Clint Eastwood character from a Western, the epic wanderer, the stoic, the man who lives on canned beans and shoe leather, and the hard-bought realities of the road. But wouldn't my father have been happier if he were in love with a woman and living in a clean and tidy house? I loved my father, and I understood well the allure of this iconic Western fantasy, but the possibility that I might end up like my father, old, alone, and dying, scared the shit out of me as I floated naked on my back in the hotel pool west of Houston. It frightened me so intensely that back in the RV I told my father that I wouldn't make it all the way to California, that I needed to return to New York ASAP to take care of some things, and what I needed to take care of was myself. We made it to Lockhart that afternoon and ate barbecue at Kreitz Market. We made it into Austin and drank a few beers at a bar, and my father glared with passion at the college girls who served us. So did I, and in the morning I flew home. And then the book gets really good. Thanks. I'll take questions. Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Peter Boyle has sold a lot of books to the Tanner Tavern. I know they appreciate it. I don't watch TV. I don't own a TV. But I'm a reading person.
Thank you for being a reading person.
Yeah. I would like to, I don't know how much time you may have, but I bought three of your books here, the last one and the other two, which are in paperback. I appreciate your time in reading the passages, but I'm looking at the back of this book, Jarhead, and it said, when the U.S. Marines are jarheads and so forth, you know the paragraph. What I would like to hear from you is your own narrative, disclosures, et cetera, about post-traumatic stress disorder and what your personal experience is, what your rank was in the mm-hmm. Marines. I was a former Army officer.
Okay, so sure.
Tell us about yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I could, Jarhead was, the question was about, the question was about my life in the Marine Corps and the book Jarhead and a little something about PTSD and about me. Well, I'm not going, I don't think I have PTSD. I think I behaved badly and erratically and kind of crazily for a number of years, and that I was indeed after a combat high that I had experienced and that I think a lot of veterans experience. My time in the Marine Corps was, I was young, I was 18. The Marine Corps stamps a very intense tattoo on young, mostly young men who then go off to combat. And, I came back and for many years I thought that I'd left the Marine Corps behind, that I had walked out and slapped my boots together like a couple of racers and had gotten rid of the Marine Corps. But then about 10 years later, I wrote this book, Jarhead, about the Marine Corps, about my time in the Corps and my time at war. And, the new book is about my time after war and trying to make sense in a way of what combat meant and what life after combat can mean. Next. Yes, ma'am.
What is life after combat? I heard stories of stress and so on. Maybe you could explain. We just came in. So.
Okay. Yeah, the question is, what is life after combat? Well, there's the old story. You send 100 guys to war and you get 100 war stories, and 100 guys come back from war and you probably get 100 different stories of, what is life after combat? Life for me after combat, was kind of difficult. It took me a while to transition back. It took me a while to trust people. One thing that happens in combat is you're hypervigilant and you're trained to be hypervigilant, and that will help you survive and it will help you save the lives of others, and it becomes a natural way of living. And then when you return, that's not natural, and it takes some time to make sense of the world and to normalize. I took classes at a community college and dropped out all the time. I worked a swing shift in a warehouse where I didn't really have to talk to people except other weird guys driving forklifts, at midnight. Guys who I loved, but mostly also veterans who had these kinds of jobs that kept them kind of on the outskirts of society, willfully on the outskirts. And only upon writing my first book, Jarhead, did I really publicly claim to be a veteran. And then really spending time, something that I discovered recently, I was writing a piece for Newsweek on PTSD and on suicide, the increased rates of suicide in the current veteran population. And only then did I make this realization about myself. And it was that in about a decade since Jarhead had come out, I had very much enjoyed the company of other veterans. And that there was something very healing, I could say, about what clinically would probably be called peer-to-peer work, but was also just a social world where I was understood. I went to the rarefied University of Iowa Writers Workshop for graduate school, and that's a place where I was not understood. And I was like the weird guy who'd been in the Marines, and No one really knew what that was or what it meant. But when I drop into a room of, you know, vets, I know the language. I can use the language. I know the codes. I know what things mean. I know the hierarchy. And I found comfort in the company of other veterans. And, you know, some guys come back from combat and they become high school math teachers and boom, they're back in it. And they never have any kinds of issues. And, you know, for other guys, it takes decades for that psychological dust to kind of come loose again. Yes?
Tell us about becoming an author.
The question was about becoming a writer. You know, I'd always wanted to be a writer. I grew up I was 14 when I first, the bug to become a writer really caught me. I'd always been a loner and a reader, you know, like most writers, but I was a big fan of Steinbeck, and Cannery Row was one of my favorite books, probably because there's a lot of booze and women in Cannery Row, let's be honest. But my family took this trip to Cannery Row, and this was in probably 83 or 84, and the Cannery Row that I was experiencing was so boring compared to John Steinbeck's Cannery Row. Like, this Cannery Row in front of me was cotton candy and carnival and this very tacky stuff. And I thought, gosh, I want John Steinbeck's Cannery Row. And that was the first time that I think I realized, you know, that writing can render and make a vivid world and give meaning. But I wasn't the greatest student. And then I went off and joined the Marine Corps. But lucky for me, because, you know, in the end, the Marine Corps gave me my first and, you know, possibly my best subject, which is war. Any other questions? In the back, yes?
Yeah, I guess I was moved that you took a trip with your dad in an RV, and I was wondering, like, what the catalyst was that...
Sure. Yeah, the question... the questioner said that she was moved that I took an RV trip with my dad and was wondering what the catalyst was. When I told people there are three RV trips that I narrate in the book, and when I first told people, friends, that I was about to jump in an RV with my dad for 1,100 miles, they looked at me like I was crazy. I said, "What are you thinking, man? Are you, you know, that is insane." And it was. It was. The first trip is early on in the book, and my father and I had a really complicated, complex, deeply troubling, and seriously deteriorating relationship. One reason I really hated my father at this point in my life. One reason was he hadn't attended my older brother's funeral in 1998, and it was something I couldn't forgive him for. And but my father asked me to go on this trip, and I have to give him credit for that. He you know, willingly enclosed himself in this, you know, 44-foot Winnebago. I don't know if you've ever driven a Winnebago, but it's like trucking down the highway in your own earthquake. Everything's moving and it's hard to keep on the road. But on that first trip, it was the middle of the night, and we were just east of Wells, Nevada, and it was probably 3 a.m. and I'd been driving and I was exhausted, and my dad reached across and grabbed my arm and he said, "Hey son, I think we need to talk. I think maybe we need to clear the air." You know, I was like, "Are you kidding me, man? Like, of course, but not right now." You know, like, that's an understatement of the decade, number one. And that trip, you know, didn't end well. We were still arguing, but I jumped in the RV with him a few more times because I did want to reconcile with him. And I was the section that I read. You know, I was pushing. That was the second trip, and I was fast approaching 40, and I was single and I was alone, and I was having what I call a reverse midlife crisis. Like, I'd wrecked the sports car, I'd blown all the money, I'd gone through a bunch of women and booze and drugs, and I wanted love, and I wanted a station wagon and a couple kids. And in order to figure out if I had what it would take to live that life, I needed to be around my father a little more and try to figure him out and reconcile. But did I answer your question? Yeah. But those same friends who, when I first said I was about to jump in an RV with my father and said, "Are you crazy?" After these trips, you know, some of them were jealous and they said, "Oh, I wish my old man would have asked me to do that. I wish I could have had that with my father." And so I have to, you know, I must thank my father for having the initial courage to ask me to take these trips with him. Was he going anywhere in particular? Sort of. That trip was to get to Montana for a niece's college graduation, and then the trip around the South, he was just kind of poking around. And another trip, the trip where I emptied the septic tank in Grand Junction, I was actually on my way to Aspen for this disabled veterans event that I try to go to every year, where they teach disabled veterans adaptive skiing up in Snowmass. It's a great event it's like a highlight of my year every year, is making it out there. I'll see you. Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. How are we on time?
It's 8:15.
Okay. Are you the timekeeper? Yeah, I think I can do one more. Yeah, or two more. Okay. Yes, ma'am.
I was wondering, you know, how young guys like 18 feel about going to war. You know, I have always had a great deal of difficulty with it, like these guys killing each other. I just hear how young guys talk about it.
Well, the question was about how young guys feel about going to war. Yeah, it depends on the guy. War is intoxicating. War is there's a romance. It's not by coincidence that mostly it's young men who go to war, and mostly it's young men who die. It can give people meaning. It can be the most exciting moment in people's lives. It can also, you know, crush lives. You know, it's complex. It's big. It's probably after childbirth, it's probably the craziest human event that we have. And the cost is sometimes deep. But you know, some people are able at some point to find value. I'd also, you know, there's the great quote by Philip Caputo, who was a Marine lieutenant in Vietnam, who said, he says in the opening pages of his book, A Rumor of War, you're about to discover that the most violent thing in the world is your average 18-year-old American farm boy. And, you know, that's because he's been trained for this thing called war. One more question. Anyone else? Yes, sir. Well, the question was about Jarhead. It is autobiographical. I don't know if I'll do that here, because I'm reading from this other book. I don't want to get too anecdotal. Off the top of my head, I wrote that book like 11 years ago. Off the top of my head, an anecdote from the desert. It was hot and I sweated a lot, but I'll be happy to talk with you afterwards, sir.
Okay.
But
well,
yeah.
Question.
Okay.
Where's your dad?
Where's my dad? My father's in Fairfield, California. Yeah. He's still trucking in his RV. You know, I sent him a copy of the book yesterday. So, no. He did attend a reading that I did of the book a couple of weeks ago in Sacramento, California, and I read the nice parts. And
you mentioned in Jarhead that you didn't feel like he came across that well, and I would think that I'm not sure he comes across much better as far as I'm into the book yet.
Yeah, I don't know that my father comes off well in the book. I'm honest about him. I'm honest about the past. I'm honest about what kind of father he was. I think my father is a sophisticated enough guy to know that, you know, what I'm digging at is some kind of greater truth, something about fathers and sons and about history, and for me especially, more so about my future and what my future might mean.
Yeah, children.
I now have a 9-month-old daughter. The question was if I have children. Thanks. But okay, thanks everyone. Thanks for coming to the Tattered Cover.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.